ages, I ride in this wind on my good horse.
It's as if we currently suffer from a form of dementia, and because we all have it, our reference points are fairly close to each other. Some people are a little bit different to others, but generally we're all in the same sort of state. Perhaps we've got it back to front. Maybe our current state is more like a really bad trip.
From somebody else, and as we go right.
You're listening to episode 652 of Unwelcome Guests. Is humanity in its right mind? I'm Robin Upton, and you've just heard a couple of snippets from brain researcher Tony Wright, who claims, no, humanity is definitely not in its right mind. Most people, for almost all of their lives, are living left-brain-dominated existences. And remember, the left brain has a penchant for the dead over the living. This is certainly controversial research, and he is not a professor or a doctor, but his ideas are worthy of more study and mesh pretty closely with a lot of the ideas that we've heard on the show. Most fundamentally, perhaps, the fact that there is something very wrong with the world. Things are not at all as they should be. Now, he suggests this is due to people living left-brain-dominated lives, and says that over a period of tens of thousands of years, human brain has been starved of what it needs to live in a healthy balance. We're going to hear more about that in just a minute, but I thought let's hear some Lynn Gerry. It's been a while since I've heard her voice. This is her introduction to episode 465, in which she is sharing her conviction that the world is not as it should be.
Reading from Charles Eisenstein's The Ascent of Humanity. The mark of how lost our society is can be seen in the fact that almost nobody has ever heard of this book, when its contents should be a topic of discussion in every bar and cafe, instead of whatever nonsense is mostly being talked about. So now I'm reading it to you, and you can talk about it. Reading this book is sometimes hard for me because I have to stop, because I'm crying, not out of grief, but of joy, that someone has finally written a book about how I have felt all my life, and the realization that I'm not alone, and that so many people feel what I feel, even if they have no words to talk about it. They feel, we feel, that something terrible is wrong with our society, that something is missing, in spite of the fact we're told that we live in the most wonderful country, in the most wonderful time in the history of humanity. To me, it has seemed ugly and horrible since as far back as I can remember, which is about the age of 3 years old. I always felt, when I was growing up, that I was the only person who felt this way. I remember when I was very small, I did not want to be a little girl, and I did not want to grow up to be a big girl. I did not even want to be a human being. Somehow, probably on television, I saw an image of wild horses running, and I wanted to be a horse. I even made people call me horse for a while. I did not want to be a woman in a girdle talking out about dresses, or a man in a suit talking about his bosses. At that time, there were a lot of westerns, TV shows and movies, and the kids used to play cowboys and Indians. But I only wanted to play Indians, because it was obvious that the cowboys were bad guys. You could tell, because when they went to the gunfight, there was always a close shot of their boots walking on the ground with their spurs jangling. And that showed that they were evil because they wore those spurs to torture horses. And also in other movies, they chased wild horses and put nooses around their necks. And the only way the horses would carry them was if they hurt them and tied them up. But the horses carried the Indians without any of those things because they loved them, because they were beautiful, just like the horses. Their hair was long and flowing like a mane, and they had beautiful designs on their face and feathers, and beautiful singing and dancing around the fire. Of course, I did not know they weren't real Indians. I know I have Native people who listen to this show, so I ask you please to understand that I mean no mockery or disrespect, but quite the opposite. I didn't know that there even were real Indians, because all the people that seemed beautiful to me, Indians, pirates, and Robin Hood, all seemed to have lived in the past. And all it seemed were left were men in ugly suits and ties with no hair, and women who looked equally awful. This was the early 1960s. A while ago, I played a series of talks of Onondaga elders and other Haudenosaunee talking about the Onondaga's attempt to regain control of their ancestral lands so they can remove the poisons dumped all over the Syracuse area by our perverted culture. At one of those talks in the lobby, I met a Mohawk woman, and she was talking about how she had been subjected to Christianization as a child, and how all the movies in Hollywood had denigrated Indians and made her ashamed of her heritage. And I had to tell her that I didn't mean to minimize what she had gone through, but that oddly enough, all of the TV shows I saw with the Indians, I thought the Indians were wonderful. And of course, I've since realized something, and in Charles Eisenstein's book has made me realize it, that the people who made those shows thought the Indians were wonderful too. Otherwise, they couldn't have made them so fabulous. But of course, they had to pretend like they thought the Indians were the bad guys, because you were supposed to think the Indians were bad and the cowboys were good. But somebody on that film crew didn't believe that either. I'm telling this story because to me it relates directly to what Charles Eisenstein is talking about, and we'll explore further in this week's material, which I think is amazing. He's going to talk about the real meaning of the Garden of Eden, how we suffer longing for it. He's going to talk of play and the universe and the world of the machine and how art was demeaned into work. Then I heard about Adam and Eve and the Garden of Eden, and it made no sense to me at all. I couldn't understand why it was bad to know the difference between good and evil, or why it was bad to want to know anything. Wasn't I going to school so that I could learn things? And it seemed to me that going to school was good, or so my parents clearly thought. And I really couldn't understand how knowing about good and evil could make you ashamed to be naked. My dog wasn't ashamed, and horses weren't ashamed. And if we were made in the image of God, as they claimed, then why should we be ashamed of it? My parents weren't ashamed to be naked. I couldn't understand how anyone could tell such a dumb story. And it is a dumb story, and that's because it is a corrupted story, like an old computer file that has become garbled. This week, you'll hear what the actual story was more like. The version that the Yuroks still tell, who have it right, who understand why religion was invented. Eisenstein will explain that it was meant to be and means a tying back to the happiness we felt when we were still like other animals, before we began the ascent of humanity, the ascent into abstraction in the human realm. During this ascent, we have gained much and also lost much. But Eisenstein's vision is not a linear one of a paradise forever lost, but a promise of in some way completing a full circle. Last week, I read about the various technologies of mind that have introduced levels of abstraction that separate us from direct experience as part of nature. The use of language, the use of numbers, the measuring of time among them. During the ascent of humanity, we have developed these technologies to create and expand a human realm. And along this journey, this realm has increasingly divorced itself from the natural world and increasingly emulated the paradigm of the machine. But this paradigm has gone as far as it can go. And that is the topic of Eisenstein's book, to go from what he calls the age of separation to the age of reunion.
Now let's hear the reading from Eisenstein's Ascent of Humanity. But just before we do that, here's a thought. Perhaps what he refers to as the reunion might be a reunion of the two sides of the human brain. Now that's going to become slightly less cryptic, I hope, as the show continues. This week, Tony Wright talks about how our ancestors lived in the tropical forest and suggests that they lived in a very different conscious state and that their brain was working differently. Could that perhaps be the case about the piraha?
The marvelous piraha. Some months after writing the rest of this chapter, I came across the work of Daniel Everett, a linguist who has spent more than a decade studying the language and culture of the Piraha. The Piraha, a small tribe of hunter-gatherers in Brazil, have resisted, with breathtaking consistency, all the developments in linguistic abstraction, representational art, number, and time described above. While this tribe has been in contact with other Brazilians for two centuries, for some reason they have maintained an extreme degree of linguistic and cultural integrity, remaining monolingual to this day. Significantly, in not just one, but all the areas described in this chapter, they exhibit very little of the separation implicit in modern symbolic culture. They do not impose linearity onto time. They do not abstract the specific into the generic through numbering. They do not usually genericize individual human beings through pronouns. They do not freeze time into representation through drawing. They do not reduce the continuum of color to a discrete finitude by naming colors. They have little independent concept of fingers, the basis for number, grasping and controlling, nor do they use fingers to point. Most strikingly, the Piraha are unable to count. Not only do they have no words for numbers, their language also lacks any quantifiers such as many, some, or all. Even more amazing, they apparently are incapable of even learning to count. Despite 8 months of sustained efforts, speech pathologist Peter Gordon failed to teach them, even with the Piraha's enthusiastic cooperation. They cannot mimic a series of knocks because they cannot keep count of how many there have been. The Piraha language is nearly devoid of any sort of abstraction. There is no semantic embedding, as in locutions like, "I think she wants to come." "She wants to come" is a nominalized phrase embedded in "I think." The lack of nominalized phrases means that words are not abstracted from reality to be conceived as things in themselves. Grammar is not an infinitely extendable template that can generate meaning abstractly through mere syntax. Words are used only in concrete reference to objects of direct experience. There are, for example, no myths of any sort in Piraha, nor do the Piraha tell fictional stories. This absence of abstraction also explains the lack of terms for numbers. Even colors do not exist in the abstract for Piraha. While they are clearly able to discern colors and use words like blood or dirt as modifiers to describe colored objects, these words do not refer to any color in the abstract. One cannot say, for example, "I like red things" or "do not eat red things in the jungle" in Piraha. Even the very idea of abstract representation is apparently impossible to explain to the Piraha. Everett describes his own attempt, quote, "If one tries to suggest, as we originally did in a math class, for example, that there is actually a preferred response to a specific question, This is unwelcome and will likely mean changing subjects and or irritation. As a further example of this, consider the fact that Paraha will write stories on paper I give them, which are just random marks, then read the stories back to me, i.e. just telling me something random about their day, etc., which they claim to be reading from their marks. They may even make marks on paper and say random Portuguese numbers while holding the paper for me to see. They do not understand that such symbols should be precise. Demonstrated when I ask them about them or ask them to draw a symbol twice, in which case it is never replicated, and consider their writing as exactly the same as the marks that I make. Close quote. Abstraction is also absent from their art. The Paraha do not draw representational figures at all, except for crude stick figures used to explain to the anthropologists the spirit world, of which they claim direct experience. They cannot even draw straight lines. As Everett continues from above, quote, "In literacy classes, however, we were never able to train a Paraha to even draw a straight line without serious coaching, and they are never able to repeat the feat in subsequent trials without more coaching." Close quote. This is highly significant, given that the straight line is in itself an abstraction being absent from nature. It is an abstraction, moreover, fraught with powerful cultural and psychological implications. At the most literal level, the Paraha do not engage in linear thinking. The absence of linear thinking comes out in the language, which lacks tenses, not only in the morphosyntactical sense of conjugations and tense markers. There is simply no verbal way to fix an event at a specific point in the past or future. For Paraha doesn't have words for tomorrow, yesterday, next month, or last year. The sentence, "Let us meet here in 3 days," or even, "Let us meet here tomorrow," is inexpressible in Paraha. Paraha has only 12 time words at all, such as day, night, full moon, high water, low water, already, now, early morning, and another day. None of them allow the establishment of a timeline. Accordingly, the Paraha have no sense of history, no stories that reach back before living memory, and no creation myths. Paraha say, when pressed about creation, for example, simply, "Everything is the same," meaning nothing changes, nothing is created. They often do not know the names of their deceased grandparents. Their kinship terms do not apply to dead people. Theirs is a timeless world. The past, after all, is just another abstraction as soon as it extends back before living memory. The Paraha similarly abstain from projection into the future, sharing with other hunter-gatherers the nonchalance and disdain for food storage described in Chapter 1. They are aware of food storage methods, such as drying, salting, and so forth, but only use these techniques to make items for barter. For themselves, they store no food, explaining to Everett, quote, "I store meat in the belly of my brother," close quote. In other words, says Everett, they share with those who need meat, never storing for the future. A further level of interpretation of this statement is also possible, however. Taken literally, it suggests a different conception of self-interest, and therefore a different conception of self. To help another is to help oneself. We are not separate. Like other hunter-gatherers, the Paraha have few material possessions, and those they do possess are very impermanent. Baskets that last a day or two, dwellings that last until the next storm. Their material culture makes no provision for security in the future, no provision for progress, betterment, or accumulation. A final refusal of separation lies in the Paraha's incapacity to form an abstract concept of value. Unable to understand money, they rely on barter for trade, and in these transactions tend to be painfully ingenuous. They present what they have to offer, Brazil nuts, raw rubber, and so forth, and point to items in the trader's boat, until the trader says they are paid in full. There is little connection, however, between the amount of what they bring to trade and the amount of what they ask for. For example, someone can ask for an entire roll of hard tobacco in exchange for a small sack of nuts or a small piece of tobacco for a large sack. Yet the Paraha are intelligent people, skillful hunters and fishers, with a well-developed sense of humor. The main thrust of Daniel Everett's paper is to refute a widely accepted hypothesis in linguistics, Hockett's design features for human language, which lays out a dozen or so characteristics of human language it claims are universal. Paraha, says Everett, defies at least three of those characteristics. I believe that Hockett's design features only appear universal to us because of our present perspective of separation. Contrary to Hockett, Paraha is severely limited in its ability to speak of events removed in time and space from the act of communication, displacement, and in its ability to generate new meaning via grammatical patterning, productivity. All of this stems from the resistance of the Paraha to the distancing from reality that we call abstraction. From numbers to colors to time, there is much that the Paraha language is constitutionally unable to express, inviting the conclusion that the Paraha are a cognitively impoverished and socially isolated people. Moreover, theirs happens to have the fewest phonemes of any known language, just 3 vowel sounds and 7 consonants for women, 8 for men. Accustomed as we are to associating communication with semantic meaning, we can only conclude that the Paraha suffer an extreme poverty of communication. Of great significance, then, is Everett's observation that the Paraha communicate almost as much by singing, whistling, and humming, non-symbolic modes of voice communication, as they do by speaking. A rich prosody enhances their verbal communication as well. Could it be that they are closer to the original language than the rest of the world, mired as it is in representation and abstraction? Perhaps it is we, not they, who suffer a poverty of communication.
An important question unaddressed by Eisenstein and Everett: if the language doesn't have means to communicate these ideas, do these ideas, the semantic embedding, the abstraction, do they even exist in the minds of the Paraha? Quite a speculative thought. And I don't know if anybody suggested inducing a Paraha to visit a Western hospital or bringing a brain scan machine down to the Amazon, quite an undertaking, I think, to investigate whether their thought is measurably different according to the Western reductionist science. Now, that may, of course, be, on one level, a stupid question. Now we're going to hear the interview with Tony Wright, our Western reductionist mindset, the left brain dominated mode of thinking, he suggests is fundamentally flawed. That's a problem if you're listening to my words, because that's a domain ruled by the left brain. We're going to hear something towards the very end of the show to suggest that isn't sort of completely black and white, trying to avoid oversimplification, but now we're going to hear what Tony Wright has to say. This is from 2012.
Traditionally, we start with the path. You know, I mean, how did you get there? What on earth took you from where you were to being a researcher in the field?
Indeed, good question. Well, it's going back about 20 years now, and I had no real great sort of vision or ambition to end up doing anything like this. I just happened to be a student at Edinburgh Botanic Gardens in Scotland, mostly studying sort of plants and plant sciences and related studies. And through a number of, I guess, coincidences, if that's how you want to see them, I ended up getting more interested in the human condition. So I sort of had some background in plant sciences and evolutionary theory, the classic Darwinian theory, and I began to get interested in what seemed to me to be gaps in the sort of traditional view of human origins, and particularly how it related to our current state of mind and perhaps some of the problems we're currently facing in terms of our health and also our perception, and these Arcadian traditions that talk about humanity perhaps not functioning as well as we may have done at one time. So those were kind of some of the clues I was confronted with about 20 years ago, and I just started digging around and eventually started doing some experiments myself, self-experimentation, and from that emerged this sort of embryonic idea that really there was perhaps a serious problem that we'd become blind to, and the problem was residing where all the tradition said it was, something to do with our mind, something in our head.
Right. Now, we're for the sake of clarity, for those who are listening and just joined us, let's be plain about this. We're going to talk about right and left brain and the influence that those have had historically. I mean, you've got some amazing theories on that. You could say, couldn't you, or people have said, that it's really like two separate cells, two identities running inside the same skull. In fact, you know, in some situations, it's even more than two identities. You know, it gets very, very confusing. But that's where we're coming from, isn't it? Now, I've got to tell you, Tony, that I would have liked Julian Jaynes to be part of this series. You know who he is. And he had a very interesting story. And I wonder if I could call on you to tell his story. I mean, I know it's not your story, but it's a fascinating idea he came up with, this bicameral mind thing, and that maybe way back in the distant past, we were hearing right brain messages that people interpreted as the voice of God or gods speaking to them. Do you want to kick off by describing his model? I know we're going to diverge from it, so don't worry, I'm not holding you to that model.
But, sure, well, I did come across his work again some while ago, probably a good 15 years ago or more now, in fact. It might even have been about 20 years ago, not long after I got interested myself and began to realize that some of what I was working with fitted into the classic left-right brain ideas, although with a significant variation. And my understanding of his work, I mean, I don't profess to be any kind of expert, although I did read his book quite early on, but he seemed, or my interpretation is anyway, that he seemed to be talking, again, about the left and right side of the brain, and that some of the traditions that have come down to us and some of the functions, sort of more poetic way of looking at the world and even the way we communicate, were relics of more access to our, how we currently describe it, the right side of our brain, and including perhaps the way communication was conveyed in the way we describe things, or our ancestors describe voices of the gods and so on, as you mentioned. He was basically saying that from that almost perpetual semi-schizophrenic state emerged a more singular sense of self, the more modern and advanced, perhaps, as we currently, or most of us currently tend to think of it, sense of self, more dominated by the left side of our brain. So he was talking about more of a sort of cohabitation model, I think. That would be my interpretation. And that slowly dissolved. I think he was onto something. He was a bit short, perhaps, on mechanisms and why all this happened. And I personally think he was documenting, to some degree, what I would call the tail end of some kind of shared perspective or shared dominance. So I think he was partly correct, in my opinion, anyway. Though, again, I think the idea that we then emerged into perhaps a more functional or advanced state, we may have that back to front. So some parallels and some differences, but that's my understanding, very simplistically, of what he was trying to get across.
Yeah, I think the important point from his theories was that, not that the right brain or left brain was actually necessarily better, and these voices from the right, I don't think he was saying they were better or worse, just simply that we hadn't connected, you know, we hadn't twigged that it was us, that people thought it was a god. As you say, he was very short on mechanism, but he was very good on evidence. I mean, I think his evidence is extremely convincing. You know, he found these inscriptions and carvings and statues where there was often a little god on the person's right shoulder whispering in their ear. So they were clearly getting sort of right-sided signals, according to this tradition. And that it was only about 3,000 years ago, you know, give or take, when this started to disappear. And the carvings switched to being thrones of gods that were empty. You know, like, where are the gods? It's all gone.
Yes.
It's like,
yes,
mankind had become very puzzled. So it's a very persuasive argument, and it could be true, and it certainly doesn't not fit with, I think, with what you're going to tell us.
Exactly.
We don't need to argue that this, you know, in Julian Jaynes' theory, whether the right brain was better or worse. It's just that it nobody had made the connection that it was really yours anyway. So they called it gods. But anyway, so that's what we're going to be talking about, folks. Now, you've got a different take, you. And I've got to tell you, there's a slight warning, Tony. This idea that in the past it was all beautiful and golden and so on is a well-known psychological phenomenon. People believe it, even if you show them the statistics from, you know, like more murders, more disease, more miserable states of life, they still believe the past was more perfect and heavenly.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, beware of that degree of skepticism. But your model is that the right brain is the good half and the left brain is the bad half. Do you want to explain how your version works? There's a lot of physiology here. Well, no, I don't expect you to do it all in one breath. But
sure, I'll try and sort of come up with some fairly straightforward explanations. But yeah, in some ways that's a little bit simple, although it certainly comes across like that. I'm certainly operating on a different timeline than even Julian James was. I'm looking at, you know, perhaps the last quarter of a million years, which isn't such a huge time in evolutionary theory, but in terms of human history would be considered a very distant epoch, I guess. And what I've proposed really is that at one time, and this partly deals with your comments on, you know, the way we idealize the past, which I'm very familiar with, that is what we tend to do, but I don't think that precludes a very real possibility that something was very different in the past and may have been better. Obviously, it doesn't prove it was there as well. Looking at the evolutionary data, what I put together was an idea that our neural system developed very differently, particularly in the forest, and the sort of the classic specialized abilities that are currently ascribed to each hemisphere and are there to some degree in most neural systems or most sort of higher organisms than neural systems. I propose that those differences were pretty much ironed out. They were smoothed over by a layer of neural tissue that really wasn't so much specialized. It had all the best of everything and was much more unified, worked as a singular system. And that was entirely dependent on an ongoing and evolving symbiotic relationship with the tropical forest, particularly, well, it's to do with diet, but diet tends to have too much baggage. So I'm really talking about the biochemical input from the tropical forest and all the sort of hormonally active factors changed the way our brain developed. And we ended up with this very different system. So rather than it being that we were more right brain, we just had a singular system that worked very well and very differently. And obviously that affected how we would perceive ourselves and all of our functions. So that's sort of going back to the origins. And then we've ended up, for reasons that I hope I can explain fairly clearly, we've ended up almost beginning to revert to type, where one side of our brain has reverted more quickly than the other. It's lost a lot of these what might be termed highly advanced or certainly very unique functions, and that's the sort of dominant force in our existence now. We currently ascribe these traits to the left side of our brain, where there's some relic function remains in the right side of our brain. So it sort of ties in with the left-right brain ideas, but it's rather than talking about adaptation, I'm talking about a process of degeneration. It's really a diagnosis of a condition that I think was alluded to in virtually all the Arcadian mythology and spiritual traditions, and even where Julian James picks up the story, he's talking about a change where there were last glimpses of something that was difficult to understand and slowly disappeared altogether, and we're now left pretty much dominated by a conceptual worldview and of ourselves and how we communicate, and we tend to mistake that for reality. And again, the modern neurological data is very interesting when you look at it with these questions in mind.
Right. Now, a great part of your hypothesis, I mean, it's a very coherent hypothesis, but you need to explain it, is that diet changed brain size, and it has to do with hormonal inhibitions and so on. Can you, without making it too technical, can you talk us through that, Tony?
Sure. Again, I'll try and break it down as best I can. You're right, it's a very contextual model, and this is something I've been working on to try and explain it more simplistically. But again, it's back to these distant origins, which are well supported in the modern data and hinted at in some of the Arcadian mythology. Even I would say even the Genesis story, however real it is, certainly has some interesting elements when there's talk of living naked in a forest where fruit's available, which that can only be the tropical forest, the non-seasonal tropical forest. And the modern take on that's very similar. Our origins tropical forest, East Africa somewhere. And we formed, again, well documented, we formed varying degrees of symbiotic relationship with the flowering plants. And that led to the co-evolution of fruit. The fruit expanded as part of the seed dissemination, the relationship where primates and other animals distribute the seeds. And this relationship became much more entangled and complicated as time went on. Now, people talk about the functional side of that, the seed dissemination and so on. But if you look at the biochemistry, there's a very unique element in this. And what we were really forming a relationship with was the sex organs of the plants, the flowers, and ultimately the fruit. And that's really extremely rare. And of course, if you start ingesting, it's dietary, of course, if you start ingesting the sex organs of a whole other kingdom, let alone another species, you're flooding yourself with the developmental environment hormones. Like in mammals and in humans, we have steroids, we have estrogens and testosterone and a lot of secondary hormones that play a massive role in the transcription of DNA and in the reading of the blueprint, and that dictates the structure and therefore the function and so on. Well, if you start ingesting these chemicals from the plant kingdom, they're all evolved to read DNA, but of course they read it differently because the DNA molecule is pretty much the same in plants and animals, so it will respond to hormones, but of course it'll do different things. And a lot of these plant chemicals, these plant hormones, very significantly modify our own hormones, particularly the steroids, the testosterone, estrogen complex, and tends to modify them in an inhibitory way, tends to dampen down their function. And also there are direct effects. These plant hormones will also effectively read our DNA. They'll do different things with the DNA. So we were becoming increasingly immersed in this confluence of complex biochemistry. And amongst other things, the mechanisms today look as if it would extend our juvenile period, for example. We wouldn't reach sexual maturity so quickly, which gives us a longer window to develop a larger brain. And what you end up with is a whole plethora of relatively large and relatively complex brains, all linked to the tropical forest. Ours being no exception. But if it's a symbiotic relationship, it's of course interdependent. You end up effectively becoming a singular organism. You lose the individual mammal, you lose the individual primate, and the trees that it's feeding on, and it becomes or at least anything that emerges from that relationship becomes a singular organism. So that's what I proposed as the mechanism driving the emergence of our unique neural system, and ultimately giving rise to a very different state of mind and consciousness. And if there's ever a separation, if that relationship breaks down, of course there's going to be massive changes. Part of what I proposed is our DNA, the mammalian DNA, really doesn't have the complexity to build very advanced, very complex neural systems generally. They're extremely rare. What we were borrowing, without perhaps realizing it now, we were borrowing the biochemistry and particularly the hormones from the tropical forest trees, particularly from their developmental environments. And that's what led to the rapid expansion and the very advanced neural architecture. Of course, since we've become disconnected, that's been eroding and reverting to type. So we've ended up with a progressively more primitive neural system, to the point now, I'd say, in our current state, which this model, it's not just looking at the past, it's looking at the mess we're in, really. We've become blithely unaware of how dysfunctional our neural system is. We tend to talk about how advanced we are while ignoring the massive amount of evidence as to what we're doing to ourselves and the place we live. And really, I'd say it's a classic case of mental ill health. It's, you know, self-harm, which is a symptom of mental ill health. So I mean, that's a sort of brief overview, origins to current state, and saying something went seriously amiss due to this breakdown in our relationship with the forest.
Right. Oh, yeah, okay. So, I mean, we went a bit fast there. For some of the listeners, let's slow it down a minute. You're saying, I think, or correct me if I'm wrong, but that our diet at that time had critical chemicals that altered our hormonal structure, that would be no surprise to people, and I think everybody now knows that soy isoflavones, for example, are not that good an idea.
Yes.
Soy does screw up human hormones, so plants can do that, so that's not a surprise. But what you're saying is it sufficiently inhibited our hormones that instead of maturing quickly like other animals, we develop slowly up till puberty, and that's when our brains grow, you know, that period up to puberty. So by extending the development period, we develop bigger brains, really, largely due to eating certain plants rather than, you know, typical theories which are, you know, we got smarter, faster and invented fire and tools.
Exactly.
And needed bigger brains.
Yes. Yes, it was more of a, what's currently called an epigenetic effect. It wasn't so much to do with our genome, our DNA and classic selective adaptation. It was a direct effect of this relationship, which was in place for a very long time. You know, even the orthodox data suggests it went on for millions of years. And obviously within that relationship, there was an evolution of that symbiotic relationship. So yes, I think extending the juvenile window was a big factor, but also the very direct effects of this very rich chemical cocktail, an incredibly unique chemical cocktail. I mean, we all know the tropical forests are rich in biochemistry, but you pull all that together into the developmental environment and you're perhaps forming a relationship with 50, 100 different species. It's exceptionally rich in all these classes of hormones, neuroactive compounds and so on. So it wasn't just the extending windows. I think that's a big factor. It was also the way the structure was developing. It was very complex chemical transcription environment, developmental environment, and that was giving rise to unique cellular structure, subcellular structure, particularly in our neural system, which is very responsive to these things. And as I say, the idea is this was 24/7. Now, of course, the only place this can happen is the non-seasonal tropical forests, the only place you get fruit all year round for significant or even evolutionary timescales are these very small niches in the tropical forests.
Right.
If that was the home of our, or if that was our origins, our genesis, you'd expect to see clues in our physiology. For example, we'd be well adapted to that kind of environment. And the data seems to stack up very well. You know, we still retain these traits that suggest perhaps our origins, or at least the origins of our intelligence and our big brain, weren't the savanna. Other people have pointed out that really, it's a big struggle to make the savanna work because it's such an extreme environment. There's very little biochemistry there. There's very little to build a big brain with. It's very hostile. However, the non-seasonal tropical forests are very benign, both climatically. It's constantly mild and warm and wet. And there's very few large predators there. So there's a lot of things that do make sense. It's just a model that nobody's really looked at until recent times, at least. It's always been presumed that we had to get out of the forest to become smart.
Yeah.
But maybe not.
You make it sound like the womb, you know, warm and wet and safe. Sorry, go on.
That's a good analogy, and I think the tropical forest is womb-like, and then, as I say, quite literally, we were feasting on and ingesting what is the equivalent of the plant kingdom's womb. You know, it's the fruit is effectively, as I say, most of us know fruit is something to eat, maybe it's something healthy to eat, but really it's the plant's equivalent of the uterus or the womb, and that's a very unusual symbiotic relationship.
Do you think our ancestors were running around tripping, Tony, you know, this chemical feast? Do you think that's maybe where consciousness woke up, as it were?
I would go as far as saying I suspect, of course I don't know, but I suspect that their normal state of mind, remember, what we consider normal may in fact be heavily altered by the loss of all these chemicals, but their normal state of mind would be what we would currently describe today as a very altered state of mind, the kind of states of mind that people do access through things like meditation or the traditional use of plant chemicals, which isn't a surprise, of course, because if we've lost all these plant chemicals, then it's perhaps not surprising we are very susceptible to drug use and misuse. But clearly there are traditions, there have been traditions, there are still living traditions where people use various approaches very safely. And they do report an incredibly different state of mind that might be described as tripping, but perhaps we've got it back to front. Maybe our current state is more like a really bad trip.
Yeah, the mind boggles, actually, at the idea of our ancestors running around on a permanent high. But, of course, they would have had limited knowledge of biology and things like that and botany, so it would maybe just a normal to them, is what you're saying. They would go around eating things like psilocybin and other sort of vegetable-based compounds and be high, but not know any other way. It's only when you've been taken off you actually come down. Is this what you're saying?
Sure, I don't think they would have been ingesting specific things to trip in the way that some...
No, I don't mean deliberately. I mean inadvertently, yeah. As part of this very...
Well, inadvertently, yes. I think it was just normal, but I would probably say things like... I mean, obviously, people have proposed theories on psilocybin playing a role in our emergence, our consciousness emergence, and so on. I would say these things came later as palliative attempts to try and redress, rather than using one very powerful chemical or alkaloid, which tends to be the case today. That was an attempt to replace perhaps certainly hundreds, if not thousands, of perhaps milder but still neuroactive chemicals that were present 24/7. I think they were perpetually in a very different state of mind, which again, although it's not proof, but it's interesting that we have this tradition handed down to us suggesting exactly that our normal state of our very distant ancestors, I'm obviously not talking the last few thousand years, was radically different, almost too difficult to describe. And there was this degeneration, which again is echoed in all these myths, and slowly something different emerged, and eventually it became dominant. And it's the dominant theme is what we recognize as ourselves today. But it's not talked about in a positive way. It's talked about a regression or a move towards a more primitive state of mind. So yes, I think these states were perpetual. They were normal and of a much higher order than it's easy for us to even imagine today. I use the analogy, it's quite harsh, but it's as if we currently suffer from a form of dementia. And because we all have it, our reference points are fairly close to each other. Some people are a little bit different to others, but generally we're all in the same sort of state. And then people report glimpses, whether it be through judicious use of neurochemical analogues, sort of likes of psilocybin and so on, or through techniques, or occasionally spontaneously, and they're actually at a loss for words. But what they do manage to convey is remarkably similar, regardless of culture, regardless of history, or whatever. There's clearly some wiring left somewhere that sounds pretty damned amazing, to be honest. It's not a state that you wouldn't want to be in for as long as you possibly could.
Yeah. Well, you've got a sympathetic audience here, Tony. I don't think any of the listeners on this call think that brain is being. You know, we are not our brain.
No.
That leads us in the wrong direction of thinking, as you point out in your book, that, it gives the idea that we're all islands because we're all different brains. Oh, that's nonsense.
Well, absolutely not. I mean, that is a good point to clear up. Although I do use a lot of modern neurological talk, I try and be as clear as I can that I regard our neural system, which... phenomenally complex though it is, I see it as no more than a musical instrument, and our beingness is the music that it, not even that it plays, that it taps into, more like perhaps a television set or a radio or a bit like the lens in a telescope. And in its phenomenal structure, it can somehow focus this otherness. And I don't profess to come up with any ideas as to what that otherness is. It's just who we really are, and we mistake the mechanisms that facilitate that these days for who we are, when in fact we're really tapping into this much greater sense of self. Obviously sounds a little bit fluffy, but I think the mechanisms are there. They do.
Well, it's almost a sense of not self, isn't it? I mean, people often say they lose self, or, their specific identity. They tend to...
Sure, that's another way to describe it. I think the sort of state of no mind, or the losing the sense of self, but I would say that is in regard to our normal sense of who we are. I think beyond that, well beyond that, there is an effort to allude to a different sense of self, but it's not an individual sense of self. It's a very universal, very... Again, the descriptions that I've come across and the brief glimpses I've perhaps managed to sort of bring about by various techniques, it always seems to be the same, but it's phenomenally amazing. It feels amazing, talking about being permanently high. Well, some of these states seem to be they make our reference points for what we normally feel somewhat worrying. I often wonder, well, on a good day, are we just slightly less depressed than normal, and we mistake that for feeling good? And when you've had experiences with these other states, it's like it puts everything else in perspective. It changes everything forever. And these things are reported, you know, I'm sure you well know, they've been reported throughout history. They're still reported today. It's fascinating they exist at all, and why on earth we have this latent capacity to feel so much better, and not only feeling so much better, but it can bring with it powerful insights, a totally different way of looking at things, a totally different way of solving problems. And of course, there's connections with immune function and the ability to deal with very difficult diseases and pathologies and so on. So it seems like there's a wholly different system locked away in there, and it's somehow tied to a different self. And of course, it might seem too simplistic to talk about left and right brain. And I know, you know, perhaps the last 10 or 15 years there's been a lot of dismissal of the very simplistic interpretation, but I tend to think something very simple has been missed within that as well. When you look at the data on the left and right side of the brain, there's some really, really good data.
I want this from you in a minute. That's what you're here for, so I've held you back from that as long as I could.
Okay, well,
while we do the background, but of course that's what you want to say. Let me just put one point in before we move on from what you were saying. I mean, what you're describing is this wonderful state of advanced consciousness and being. I remind you or the listeners of the words of Gurdjieff, who said the biggest barrier to consciousness is the belief you're already conscious. You're saying, and I agree, that you know everybody's fast asleep. They're like in a zombie-like state, and they only occasionally wake up. It's this wake-up state that's exciting, isn't it? So go on, tell us, on your model, Tony, what do you think has gone wrong? The left brain has screwed all this up. I'd have to ask you why, you know, what physiological process may the left brain have gone through. But first of all, explain how you think it's screwing things up, and then how you think it came about. And then perhaps the third question is, what can we do about it?
Sure, of course. The whole point of this is, what can we do about it? I'm not really interested in pointing out the pathology if there's no solutions. This is really an attempt at a diagnosis, very holistic diagnosis. And I'd like to think it's simple at its core, but there is a lot of data around it. And really, I don't think so much the left brain has screwed things up per se in any other way than anybody with classic mental ill health problems simply acts out of the limits of their function. You know, if we were to visit a classic Victorian insane asylum, we wouldn't be too shocked to see people rocking backwards and forwards on chairs, harming themselves, harming each other, and there would be no blame. It would just be, well, they're clearly not very well. And I think all that's happened is back to this Arcadian past where we formed this connection, our ancestors and our relatives formed by degrees, of course, the degrees of specialization, but we formed this relationship and we started off with a split brain. One side was slightly different to the other, but, you know, very useful for adaptive purposes, for survival. So there was always a genetic variation between each side of the brain, not so much, but just enough. And that's what I'm proposing initially got ironed out by this perpetual and evolving relationship with fruit, the plant's developmental organs. When that broke down, because there was this built-in genetic asymmetry, one side being slightly different to the other, as this process went into reverse, there was a reversion and erosion. One side was always going to be affected more quickly than the other. It could have been the right side. It just happened to be the left, and it looks like it's been more susceptible more quickly to this loss of biochemistry, and it's reverted to type, or it's been reverting to type much more quickly than the right side of the brain. I think they've both been affected. I'm not saying the right brain's intact at all. I just think it's the last relics of our true essence, our humanity, and so on, whereas the left brain's reverted to a much more standard mammalian brain type. It's lacking much empathy, it's lacking much compassion, it's not too bright, although it likes to think it is, and so on. And it's, in a bizarre twist, and again, back to Julian Jayne's work, and I probably agree roughly with the timeline, it's taken perceptual control somewhere in the last 5 to 10,000 years anyway. And once it's running the show, that's where the problem really lies. It's like electing the least sighted person to drive the bus on a very dangerous road, well, of course, you're going to end up in a lot of crashes and there's going to be a lot of problems. So we're really effectively being run by the least functional side of our brain, while it's absolutely certain it's the most functional side, which is what you get. You know, it's exactly what you get with mental ill health. So I think in terms of the left brain being a problem, yes, it is a problem, but it's not bloody-minded. It's not doing this because it knows. It just doesn't know any better. It's only doing what it would do. It's much more primitive now, and it's much more into competition and control. It's very frightened, and that's what's governing all of us to some degree. And then because there's a variation in the symptomology, some people are more left brain dominant than others. What emerges in society is the people with the least functional left brains, because they're more frightened, they end up aspiring to take control. So you get the emergence of the patriarchal and hierarchical systems, and you end up again with the least functional people in charge. And we all know this, we all talk about this. I'm saying there's a neurological basis to this, and there should be evidence. I can't get away with this if there's not evidence. Well, again, once you start looking at the data is very compelling. But what you have to be very careful of is the interpretation of the data, because we're all running to some degree on our left brain. So the data's talking about delusion and all sorts of problems associated with perception and relatively poor cognitive functions. And then it comes up with these splendid explanations. Well, this is specialized adaptation and we need this, and it's really good the left brain's in charge. But of course, it's self-assessment. It's telling itself that it's really the best thing since, well, I'd say sliced bread, but that doesn't really fit here. So, it's not so much demonizing the left brain. It's really saying it's simply more affected, more afflicted, and it's ended up in charge. And we need to address that, of course, and we need to convince our own left brains that actually there's a problem here.
You talk down a little bit, you know, the left brain, you were quite critical of it, I think, in a book, but there's no question that you're a door of the right brain, so go on, launch us into that. I know all these amazing abilities that human beings are capable of, without question, come from the right brain. I mean, it's...
Sure, well, I'm sure I am critical
of... We get all our emotions from there, and we could do without some of those, so it's not a clear cut line.
I think that is the sort of... the place where the relics of our humanity still live, and of course, where very few people are totally left-brained, or of course, and incredibly rarely right-brained. So we're always drawing on our right brain, even in this current state. I mean, I focus a lot on the left brain in isolation simply to highlight its traits, but these traits do get diluted because the two hemispheres do still cooperate to some degree. And that is, as you say, that's where we draw our emotions from. Of course, these are all labels, they're all concepts. So whatever that experience is, we call emotions. And then we have things like creativity and artistic ability and poetry. But beyond that, and again, coming out of split brain research and the data on autistic savants and so on, we have phenomenal skills and abilities, and they always seem to correlate with getting access to the right brain, never ever the other way around. I've yet to come across a case where somebody suffered significant damage to their right brain and it's released amazing abilities. It's always damage to the left brain. If there is any evidence of damage, sometimes it's difficult to find the evidence, but where there is evidence, it's always damage to the left brain, and that can release function in the right brain. And it's not compensation, as some people seem to think for a while. I mean, compensation is roughly like for like. It might be slightly different. The functions that can emerge are often off the scale better. You know, eidetic memory, where people can remember everything forever. They have no possibility of forgetting it. And a lot of the savant syndrome cases demonstrate phenomenal memory, photographic memory, phenomenal artistic ability, where people can just take a look at an incredibly complex landscape just for a second, and then they can reproduce it in perfect scale and proportion and so on and so forth. Similar with music, that's where perfect pitch lives. It's clearly not in our left brain, because if it was, we'd all have it. You know, there's some very simplistic things here. If these abilities and skills were part of our dominant hemisphere's palette of skills, we demonstrate them. Well, they're very rare. And when we do get access, either spontaneously or people who have more sustained access, the data is very compelling. They don't live in the left side of our brain. So what on earth are we doing with the capacity for not something slightly better, but phenomenally better, locked away? Why is it locked away? Why do we even need techniques?